at the bottom. At these universities, you often have to wait until you are a full professor, years and years into your career, before you can start affecting the program's direction. Until this point, you follow along with what gets passed down from on high. The second thing I noticed was that Georgetown's tenure process was going to differ somewhat from the pattern of standard well-established programs. At a large research institution, tenure happens as follows. Higher-ups in the administration send out letters to other people in your general field and ask whether you're the top person in your particular specialty. If you're not, they'll fire you and try to hire whoever is. Some places go so far as to essentially tell their new hires not to expect tenure. Academic job markets are so tough, and with so much more available talent than open positions, they can get away with this. If your specialty is new, as mine is, and they can't therefore find experts with an opinion on it either way, you're going to have a real hard time keeping your position, as there's no one out there to validate your stature. Because of this, the system rewards conformity for junior faculty. That is, the safest route to tenure is to take a robust research topic that already has lots of interest and then outwork your peers. If you want to innovate, wait until later in your career. In his famed last lecture, the late Carnegie Mellon computer science professor, Randy Pausch, captured this reality well when he quipped, "Junior faculty members used to come up to me and say, 'Wow, you got tenure early. What's your secret?' I said, 'It's pretty simple. Call me any Friday night in my office at 10 o'clock and I'll tell you.'" Georgetown, by contrast, made it clear that they weren't interested in this explicit comparison-based approach to tenure. At this stage in its growth, the computer science department was more focused on developing star researchers than trying to hire them away. In other words, if I published good results in good venues, I could stay. Without pressure to choose a safe, pre-existing area to dominate, I would therefore have much more flexibility in how my research program unfolded. Viewed from the perspective of the control I would enjoy over my career, Georgetown was clearly more attractive than the well-established state university. Before finalizing my decision, however, I took some time to reflect on the other insights of Rule Number 3, insights that nuanced its otherwise enthusiastic endorsement of autonomy. During my quest, for example, I discovered two traps that typically trip people up in their search for control. The first trap was having too little career capital. If you go after more control in your working life without a rare and valuable skill to offer in return, you're likely pursuing a mirage. This was the trap tripped, for example, by the many fans of lifestyle design who left their traditional jobs to try to make a living on passive income-generating websites. Many of these contrarians quickly discovered that the income-generating piece of that plan doesn't work well if you don't have something valuable to offer in exchange for people's money. This trap might not seem relevant to my job hunt, as the academic search process usually demands large stores of career capital, in the form of peer-reviewed publications and strong recommendation letters, before a candidate has a possibility of earning an offer. But there are departments lurking out there that will attract second-tier candidates, that is, those without much career capital, with the allure of the autonomous academic life. But then, once they arrive on campus, saddle them with an overwhelming amount of teaching and service responsibilities. In other words, even in this rarefied world, one must still be wary of control mirages. The second trap describes what happens when you do have enough capital to successfully make a shift toward more control. It's at this point that you're most likely to encounter resistance from others in your life, as more control usually benefits only you. Fortunately for me, my closest advisors at MIT encouraged me to pursue the flexibility offered by a fast-growing program like Georgetown's. But there were certainly those farther out in my professional orbit who were more resistant to this decision. To them, pounding a well-trod path at a well-established university was the safest route to the desired outcome of tenure and a good research reputation. The personal benefits of having more control over my work were not on their professional radar, So any decision outside the safe decision was deemed alarming. While researching rule number 3, I came across a useful tool for navigating between these two traps. I called it the law of financial viability and described it as follows. When deciding whether to follow an appealing pursuit that will introduce more control into your work life, ask yourself whether people are willing to pay you for it. If so, continue. If not, move on. Ultimately, this was the law that helped me finalize my own career decision. Georgetown offered much greater potential for control over what I did and how I did it. This seemed clear. Furthermore, they were willing to pay me well for this move toward autonomy, both financially and in terms of support for my research initiatives. According to the law of financial viability, I could therefore be confident that in going to Georgetown, I would be avoiding both control traps. I had enough career capital to exchange for the potential flexibility and could confidently ignore the status quo-themed voices of resistance. So I turned down the interview request from the state university and held out for Georgetown. How I applied rule number 4. As explained in rule number 4, a career mission is an organizing purpose to your working life. It's what leads people to become famous for what they do, and ushers in the remarkable opportunities that come along with such fame. It's also an idea that has long fascinated me. Academia is a profession well suited for mission. If you identify professors with particularly compelling careers, and then ask what they did differently than their peers, the answer almost always involves them organizing their work around a catchy mission. Consider, for example, Alan Lightman, an MIT physics professor turned writer. Lightman started as a traditional physicist, but was writing on the side, both fiction and nonfiction, that grappled with the human side of science. He's perhaps best known for his best-selling award-winning novel, Einstein's Dreams, though he's written many other books, and his essays have appeared in basically every important American literary publication. Lightman's career is based on his mission to explore the human side of science, and this led him to fascinating places. He left behind the grueling MIT physics tenure track to become the first professor in the Institute's history to be dual appointed in both science and humanities. He helped develop MIT's communications requirement, and then went on to found its graduate science writing program. By the time I met Lightman, he had shifted to an adjunct professor position, providing him even more freedom in his schedule, and had crafted for himself an impressively unburdened life of the mind. He now teaches writing courses that he designed, and that focus on issues he thinks are important. He has freed himself from the need to be constantly seeking grant money or publications. He spends his summers with his family on an island in Maine, a location with no phone, TV, or internet, presumably thinking big thoughts while basking in the sublimity of his surroundings. Most impressive to me, Lightman's contact page on his official MIT website gives the following disclaimer. I don't use email, a move towards simplicity that a less famous academic would never get away with. This is just one example among many of professors who leveraged mission to create an offbeat and compelling career. Some of these professors, such as Pardee Sabeti and Kirk French, I ended up tracking down and interviewing when researching this book, which is why you'll find the details of their stories in rule number 4. Others, such as Alan Lightman or Erez Lieberman, who earned fame by the age of 31 through his combination of mathematics and cultural studies, or Esther Duflo, who won a MacArthur Genius Grant for her work evaluating anti-poverty programs, didn't make the cut for the book, but still weigh heavily on my thinking about how to best shape my own career. It wasn't until I got started in earnest in my rule number 4 research, however, and met mission mavens such as Pardee, Kirk, and Giles Boquette, that I understood just how tricky it is to make this trait a reality in your working life. The more you try to force it, I learned, the less likely you are to succeed. True missions, it turns out, require two things. First, you need career capital, which requires patience. Second, you need to be ceaselessly scanning your always changing view of the adjacent possible in your field, looking for the next big idea. This requires a dedication to brainstorming and exposure to new ideas. Combined, these two commitments describe a lifestyle, not a series of steps that automatically spit out a mission when completed. As I entered the summer of 2011, I leveraged this new understanding to try to transform my approach to work into one that would lead to a successful mission. These efforts generated a series of routines that I combined into a mission development system. This system is best understood as a three-level pyramid. I'll explain each of these levels next. Top level, the tentative research mission. My system is guided at the top level of the pyramid by a tentative research mission, a sort of rough guideline for the type of work I'm interested in doing. Right now, my mission reads, to apply distributed algorithm theory to interesting new places with the goal of producing interesting new results. In order to identify this mission description, I had first to acquire career capital in my field. I've published and read enough distributed algorithm results to know that there's great potential in moving this body of theory to new settings. The real challenge, of course, is finding the compelling projects that exploit this potential. This is the goal the other two levels of the pyramid are designed to pursue. Bottom level, background research. We now dive from the top level of the pyramid to the bottom level, where we find my dedication to background research. Here's my rule. Every week, I expose myself to something new about my field. I can read a paper, attend a talk, or schedule a meeting. To ensure that I really understand the new idea, I require myself to add a summary, in my own words, to my growing research Bible, which I introduced earlier in this conclusion when discussing how I applied rule number 2. I also try to carve out one walk each day for free-form thinking about the ideas turned up by this background research. I commute to work on foot and have a dog to exercise, so I have many such walks to choose from in my schedule. The choice of what material to expose myself to is guided by my mission description at the top of the pyramid. This background research process, which combines exposure to potentially relevant material with free-form recombination of ideas, comes straight out of Stephen Johnson's book, Where Good Ideas Come From, which I introduced in rule number 4 when talking about his notion of the adjacent possible. According to Johnson, access to new ideas and to the liquid networks that facilitate their mixing and matching often provides the catalyst for breakthrough new ideas. Middle level, exploratory projects. We arrive now at the middle level of the pyramid, which is responsible for most of the work I produce as a professor. As explained in rule number 4, an effective strategy for making the leap from a tentative mission idea to compelling accomplishments is to use small projects that I called little bets, borrowing the phrase from Peter Sims' 2010 book of the same title. As you might recall, a little bet, in the setting of mission exploration, has the following characteristics. It's a project small enough to be completed in less than a month. It forces you to create new value, for example, master a new skill and produce new results that didn't exist before. It produces a concrete result that you can use to gather concrete feedback. I use little bets to explore the most promising ideas turned up by the processes described by the bottom level of my pyramid. I try to keep only 2 or 3 bets active at a time so that they can receive intense attention. I also use deadlines, which I highlight in yellow in my planning documents, to help keep the urgency of their completion high. Finally, I also track my hours spent on these bets in the hour tally I described back in the section of this conclusion dedicated to my application of rule number 2. I found that without these accountability tools, I tended to procrastinate on this work, turning my attention to more urgent but less important matters. When a little bet finishes, I use the concrete feedback it generates to guide my research efforts going forward. This feedback tells me, for example, whether a given project should be aborted, And if not, what direction is most promising to explore next? The effort of completing these bets also has the added side benefit of inducing deliberate practice, yet another tactic in my ever-growing playbook dedicated to making me better and better at what I do. Ultimately, the success or failure of the projects pursued in this middle level helps me evolve the research mission maintained by the top level. In other words, the system as a whole is a closed feedback loop, constantly evolving toward a clearer and better supported vision for my work. Final thoughts. Working right trumps finding the right work. This book opened with the story of Thomas, who believed that the key to happiness is to follow your passion. True to this conviction, he followed his passion for Zen practice to a remote monastery in the Catskill Mountains. Once there, he applied himself to the study of Zen, immersing himself in meditation and pondering endless Dharma lectures. But Thomas didn't find the happiness he expected. He realized instead that although his surroundings had changed, he was exactly the same person as before he arrived at the monastery. The thought patterns that had previously convinced him, job after job, that he hadn't yet found his true calling, had not disappeared. When we left Thomas back in this book's introduction, the weight of this realization had reduced him to tears. He sat in the quiet oak forest surrounding the monastery, crying. Almost 10 years later, I met Thomas at a coffee shop not far from my building at MIT. He was working in Germany at the time, and was visiting Boston for a conference. Thomas is tall and slim, with close-cropped hair. He wears the thin-framed square glasses that seem to be mandatory issue among European knowledge workers. As we sat and sipped coffee, Thomas filled me in on his life after his Zen crisis. Here's what I learned. After leaving the monastery, Thomas returned to the banking job he had left 2 years earlier when he moved to the Catskills to pursue his passion. This time, however, he approached his working life with a new awareness. His experience at the monastery had freed him from the escapist thoughts of fantasy jobs that had once dominated his mind. He was able instead to focus on the tasks he was given and on accomplishing them well. He was free from the constant draining comparisons he used to make between his current work and some magical future occupation waiting to be discovered. This new focus and the output it produced was appreciated by management. 9 months into his job, he was promoted. Then he was promoted again. And then again. Within 2 years, he had moved from a lowly data entry position to being put in charge of a computer system that managed over $6 billion of investment assets. By the time I met him, he had been put in charge of a system that manages 5 times that amount. His work is challenging, but Thomas enjoys the challenge. It also provides him with a sense of respect, impact, and autonomy. Exactly the kind of rare and valuable traits, as you might recall, that I argued back in rule number 2 are needed for creating work you love. Thomas acquired these traits not by matching his work to his passion, but instead by doing his work well, and then strategically cashing in the capital it generated. Managing computer systems might not generate the daily bliss that defined Thomas's old daydreams, but as he now recognized, nothing would. A fulfilling working life is a more subtle experience than his old fantasies had allowed. As we chatted, Thomas agreed that a good way of describing his transformation is that he came to realize a simple truth. Working right trumps finding the right work. He didn't need to have a perfect job to find occupational happiness. He needed, instead, a better approach to the work already available to him. I think it's fitting to end on Thomas's story, as it sums up the message at the core of this book. Working right trumps finding the right work. It's a simple idea, but it's also incredibly subversive, as it overturns decades of folk career advice, all focused on the mystical value of passion. It wrenches us away from our daydreams of an overnight transformation into instant job bliss, and provides instead a more sober way toward fulfillment. This is why I left this conclusion to Thomas's saga until the end of the book. I wanted the chance to first explore with you, through the four rules that came before, the nuances of working right, providing example after example of how this approach can lead to increased enjoyment of your own working life. Now that you're armed with these insights, it's my hope that the end to Thomas's story is no longer so surprising. I love what I do for a living. I'm also confident that as I continue my commitment to the ideas discovered in my quest, this love will only deepen. Thomas feels the same way about his work. So do most of the people I profiled in the book. I want you to share in this confidence. To accomplish this goal, let the rules I uncovered guide you. Don't obsess over discovering your true calling. Instead, master rare and valuable skills. Once you build up the career capital that these skills generate, invest it wisely. Use it to acquire control over what you do and how you do it, and to identify and act on a life-changing mission. This philosophy is less sexy than the fantasy of dropping everything to go live among the monks in the mountains. But it's also a philosophy that's been shown time and again to actually work. So next time you start to question whether you're missing out on some dream job waiting for you to muster the courage to pursue it, conjure up a pair of images. First, recall passion-obsessed Thomas, heartbroken and sobbing on the forest floor. Then, replace this with the image of the smiling, confident, value-focused man who 10 years later joined me for coffee. The version of Thomas who looked at me at one point in our conversation and remarked without irony, "Life is good." Glossary. A summary of the important terms, theories, and laws introduced in the book, presented in the order of their appearance. The passion hypothesis, introduced in rule number 1. This hypothesis claims that the key to occupational happiness is to first figure out what you're passionate about and then find a job that matches this passion. The basic tenet behind this book is that the passion hypothesis, although widely believed, is both wrong and potentially dangerous. Be so good they can't ignore you, introduced in rule number 2. A quote from comedian Steve Martin that captures what is needed to build a working life you love. It is excerpted from the following longer quote, which Martin gave in a 2007 interview with Charlie Rose when asked what his advice was for aspiring entertainers. "Nobody ever takes note of my advice because it's not the answer they wanted to hear. What they want to hear is, here's how you get an agent, here's how you write a script. But I always say, be so good they can't ignore you." The craftsman mindset, introduced in rule number 2. An approach to your working life in which you focus on the value of what you are offering to the world. The passion mindset, introduced in rule number 2. An approach to your working life in which you focus on the value your job is offering you. This mindset stands in contrast to the craftsman mindset. The passion mindset ultimately leads to chronic dissatisfaction and daydreaming about the better jobs you imagine existing out there waiting to be discovered. Career capital, introduced in rule number 2. A description of the skills you have that are rare and valuable to the working world. This is the key currency for creating work you love. The career capital theory of great work, introduced in rule number 2. This theory provides the foundation for all of the ideas that follow it in this book. It claims that the key to work you love is not to follow your passion, but instead to get good at something rare and valuable, and then cash in the career capital this generates, to acquire the traits that define great jobs. This requires that you approach work with a craftsman mindset, focusing on your value to the world, and not a passion mindset, focusing on what value the world is offering you. Here is the formal 3-part definition of the theory as presented in rule number 2. The traits that define great work are rare and valuable. Supply and demand says that if you want these traits, you need rare and valuable skills to offer in return. Think of these rare and valuable skills you can offer as your career capital. The craftsman mindset, with its relentless focus on being so good they can't ignore you, is a strategy well suited for acquiring career capital. This is why it trumps the passion mindset if your goal is to have work you love. The 10,000-hour rule, introduced in rule number 2. A rule well known to performance scientists describing the amount of practice time required to master a skill. Malcolm Gladwell, who popularized the concept in his 2008 book, Outliers, described it as follows. The idea that excellence at performing a complex task requires a critical minimum level of practice surfaces again and again in studies of expertise. In fact, researchers have settled on what they believe is the magic number for true expertise, 10,000 hours. Deliberate practice, introduced in rule number 2. The style of difficult practice required to continue to improve at a task. Florida State University professor Anders Ericsson, who coined the term in the early 1990s, describes it formally as an activity designed typically by a teacher for the sole purpose of effectively improving specific aspects of an individual's performance. Deliberate practice requires that you stretch past where you are comfortable and then receive ruthless feedback on your performance. In the context of career construction, most knowledge workers avoid this style of skill development because, quite frankly, it's uncomfortable. To build up large stores of career capital, however, which is necessary for creating work you love, you must make this style of practice a regular part of your work routine. Career capital markets, introduced in rule number 2. When acquiring career capital in a field, you can envision that you're acquiring this capital in a specific type of career capital market. There are two types of these markets, winner-take-all and auction. In a winner-take-all market, there is only one type of career capital available and lots of different people competing for it. An auction market, by contrast, is less structured. There are many different types of career capital, and each person might generate their own unique collection of this capital. Different markets require different career capital acquisition strategies. In a winner-take-all market, for example, you need to first crack the code on how people master the one skill that matters. In an auction market, by contrast, you might simply emphasize rareness in the skill combinations that you create. Control. Introduced in rule number 3. Control is having a say in what you do and how you do it. This is one of the most important traits to acquire with your career capital when creating work you love. The first control trap, introduced in rule number 3. A warning to heed when trying to introduce more control into your working life. It represents the principle that control that's acquired without career capital is not sustainable. The second control trap, introduced in rule number 3. Another warning to heed when trying to introduce more control into your working life. It represents the principle that when you acquire enough career capital to acquire meaningful control over your working life, that's exactly when you become valuable enough to your current employer that they will try to prevent you from making the change. Courage culture, briefly introduced in rule number 2, elaborated in rule number 3. A term that describes the growing number of authors and online commentators who promote the idea that the only thing standing between you and a dream job is building the courage to step off the expected path. Though well-intentioned, this culture is dangerous, as it underplays the importance of also having career capital to back up your career aspirations. It has led many people to quit their current job and to end up in a new situation where they are much worse off than before. The law of financial viability, introduced in rule number 3. A simple law that can be deployed to help sidestep the two control traps when trying to introduce more control into your working life. It suggests that when deciding whether to follow an appealing pursuit that will introduce more control into your work life, you should ask yourself whether people are willing to pay for it. If so, continue. If not, move on. Mission. Introduced in rule number 4. A mission is another important trait to acquire with your career capital when creating work you love. It provides a unifying goal for your career. It's more general than a specific job and can span multiple positions. It provides an answer to the question, "What should I do with my life?" The adjacent possible, introduced in rule number 4. A term taken from the science writer Stephen Johnson, who took it from Stuart Kaufman, that helps explain the origin of innovation. Johnson notes that the next big ideas in any field are typically found right beyond the current cutting edge, in the adjacent space that contains the possible new combinations of existing ideas. The key observation is that you have to get to the cutting edge of a field before its adjacent possible, and the innovations it contains, becomes visible. In the context of career construction, it's important to note that good career missions are also often found in the adjacent possible. The implication, therefore, is that if you want to find a mission in your career, you first need to get to the cutting edge of your field. Little bets, introduced in rule number 4. An idea borrowed from the business writer Peter Sims. When Sims studied innovative corporations and people, he noted the following. Rather than believing they have to start with a big idea or plan out a whole project in advance, they make a methodical series of little bets about what might be a good direction, learning critical information from lots of little failures and from small but significant wins. In the context of career construction, little bets provide a good strategy for exploring productive ways to turn a vague mission idea into specific successful projects. The Law of Remarkability, introduced in Rule Number 4. A simple law that can help you identify successful projects for making your mission a reality. This can be used in conjunction with the little bet strategy. The law says that for a mission-driven project to succeed, it should be remarkable in two different ways. First, it must compel people who encounter it to remark about it to others. Second, it must be launched in a venue that supports such remarking. Career Profile Summaries. A quick summary of the main career profiles from the book presented in the order in which they appear. Joe Duffy, introduced in Rule Number 2. Current job. Before recently retiring, Joe ran Duffy & Partners, his own 15-person branding and design shop. Why he loves what he does. He worked on hand-picked international projects and was greatly respected and rewarded for his work. Between engagements, he spent much of his time at Duffy Trails, a 100-acre retreat he owns, tucked away on the banks of Wisconsin's Tobatuck River. How he applied the rules described in this book to get this job. When Joe was starting out in his advertising career, like many at his young age, he chafed at the constraints of working for a large company. He had originally planned on being an artist and was entertaining the thought of quitting his job and returning to that dream. Instead, Joe deployed career capital theory. He realized that the traits that define great work are rare and valuable, and that therefore they require rare and valuable skills to be offered in return. He found a specialty within his field, brand communication through logos, and hunkered down to dominate the skill. He was hired away by a larger agency, which gave him more money and more freedom. As he continued to build career capital, they appeased him by allowing him to run an independent agency within the larger agency, providing Joe even more control. Eventually, he left to run his own shop on his own terms, using the monetary rewards of his expertise to buy Duffy Trails. Given that before he retired he controlled when he worked and what he worked on, he was able to get the most out of both his work and his relaxation. Alex Berger, introduced in Rule Number 2. Current job? Alex is a successful television writer. Why he loves what he does. When you're good enough to find a steady stream of work, television writing is a fantastic gig. It pays you loads of money to do highly creative projects that are seen by millions. In addition, it also gives you months off every year. How he applied the rules described in this book to get this job. When Alex first arrived in Hollywood, Ivy League diploma in hand, he thought he could break into the industry by launching and carefully managing a variety of different entertainment-related projects. It turned out that no one cared about his big ideas. It didn't take long for Alex to pare his attention down to a more specific pursuit, television writing. He realized that all that mattered in this field was a single type of career capital, the ability to write quality scripts. Using the practice techniques honed as a college debate champion, he began to systematically improve his scriptwriting capability, sometimes working on as many as 4 or 5 writing projects at a time, while constantly exposing himself to ruthless feedback. This strategy paid off as his scriptwriting improved quickly, eventually earning him his first produced scripts, which in turn earned him his first staff writing jobs, which led to him co-creating a show with Michael Eisner. This is a classic example of career capital theory in action. To get a job he loved, Alex needed to first become so good that he couldn't be ignored. Mike Jackson, introduced in rule number 2. Current job: Mike is a director at the Westley Group, a clean tech venture capital firm on Silicon Valley's famous Sand Hill Road. Why he loves what he does. Clean energy venture capital is a hot field. It offers a way to help the world, while at the same time, as Mike admitted, you make a lot of money. How he applied the rules described in this book to get this job. Mike didn't start with a clear vision of what he wanted to do with his life. He did understand, however, the basics of career capital theory. The more rare and valuable skills you have to offer, the more interesting opportunities will become available. With this in mind, Mike formed his early career around the goal of dominating one valuable pursuit after another, trusting that the large stores of career capital this would generate would lead him somewhere worth going. He started by choosing an ambitious master's thesis project that ended up making him an expert on international carbon markets. He then leveraged this expertise to run a green energy startup that sold carbon offsets contracts to American companies. This combination of expert knowledge on green energy markets and entrepreneurship experience made him a perfect match for the Westley Group, the clean energy venture capital firm where he now works. Throughout this process, Mike's focus was on how to get better, not on figuring out his true calling. The result was an enviable job. Ryan Voiland, introduced in rule number 3. Current job. Ryan, along with his wife Sarah, runs Red Fire Farm, a thriving organic farm in Granby, Massachusetts. Why he loves what he does. Ryan has been training in horticulture since he was a teenager. To now own land that he can cultivate on his own terms is deeply fulfilling to him. How he applied the rules described in this book to get this job. Many people harbor a rosy image of farm life. They imagine it would be nice to spend time outdoors in nice weather and be free from the distractions of the modern office. Spend time with Ryan at Red Fire, however, and this myth is quickly dispelled. Farming, it turns out, is hard work. The weather is not something you enjoy as if on vacation, but instead a force poised to play havoc with your crops. And far from being free from modern distractions, a farmer is a businessman with all the email, Excel spreadsheets, and QuickBooks software that come along with that role. The reason Ryan loves what he does, it turns out, is not that he gets to be outside or free from email, but instead that he has control over both what he does and how he does it. This trait, as described in rule number 3, is crucial for creating work you love. What's important about Ryan's story is that he didn't just decide one day that farming would provide nice control and then go buy some land. Instead, he recognized that control, like any valuable career trait, requires career capital to acquire. With this in mind, he built up his farming skills for over a decade before setting out on his own. It started with cultivating his parents' garden and selling produce by the road. From there, he slowly built up his abilities by taking on larger cultivation projects. By the time he left for Cornell to study horticulture, he was renting land from a local farmer. It wasn't until after he earned his degree that he applied for a loan for his first parcel of land. Given his expertise, it's not surprising that his new farm thrived. He's a perfect example of both the value of control and the patient capital acquisition required before you can gain this trait in your working life. Lulu Young, introduced in rule number 3. Current job, Lulu is a freelance software developer. Why she loves what she does. Lulu enjoys challenging software projects, but she also enjoys having control over her life, including when she works, what she works on, and under what terms. As a freelance developer with skills that are in high demand, she has been able to maintain that control, allowing her to mix her work with a variety of different leisurely pursuits, from month-long trips to Asia, to pilot's training, to weekday afternoons spent with her nephew. How she applied the rules described in this book to get this job. Lulu, like Ryan, is a good example of the value of control. Also like Ryan, she's a good example of leveraging career capital in pursuit of this trait. Lulu didn't decide out of the blue to be a freelance developer. Instead, she built up her skills and reputation over many years in the industry. She now has more than enough career capital to set her own terms for her work. When you study her story, however, you learn that this shift toward increased autonomy didn't happen all at once. Instead, Lulu developed a steady stream of bids for increased freedom as she got increasingly good at what she did. It started with her first job as a software tester, the bottom of the developer heap. Lulu figured out how to automate much of the testing process. The capital this generated allowed her to then bargain for a 30-hour work week so she could take philosophy classes on the side. As she got even better at what she did, she invested her growing capital stores in obtaining positions at a series of startups, where she was given more and more control over her work. It was after one of these startups was acquired by a large company, which promptly added new constraints, that Lulu transitioned to a freelance role. At this point, however, her career capital stores were more than sufficient to support this final bid for even more control. Derek Sivers, introduced in rule number 3. Current job. Derek is an entrepreneur, writer, and thinker. Why he loves what he does. Derek has had enough successes in his career that he can now live where he wants and work on projects he finds interesting when he decides he's in the mood to work. He's in complete control over his life and is taking full advantage of this autonomy. How he applied the rules described in this book to get this job. Derek is another example of control being a defining trait of a great career. What made him most relevant to our discussion in rule number 3, however, is the rule he deploys when deciding whether or not to pursue a bid for more autonomy. I call this rule the law of financial viability, and it says that you should only pursue a project if people are willing to pay you for it. If they aren't, you probably don't have sufficient capital to exchange for the control you desire. This is the law that helped guide Derek to his current levels of success. He first applied it when deciding to quit his job at Warner Brothers to become a full-time musician. He delayed this decision until the money he was making from music was equal to what he made in his day job. If he couldn't get to this modest level of income with part-time playing, he reasoned, then he was unlikely to enjoy enough success pursuing this career full-time. He next applied the law when starting CD Baby, the company he eventually sold for millions. He didn't drop everything to pursue his entrepreneurial ambition. Instead, he started small. When the company made a little money, he used this money to expand it so it could make a little more. When it started to make a lot of money, only then did he decide to make it into his full-time job. The courage culture pushes us to make drastic bids for increased control over our working lives. Derek's example provides a nice reality check. Seeking freedom is good, but it's easy to fail in this pursuit. The law of financial viability provides a good guide past these pitfalls. Pardee Sabeti, introduced in rule number 4. Current job. Pardee is a professor of evolutionary biology at Harvard University. Why she loves what she does. Pardee's academic career is built around a mission that she finds both exciting and important, to use computational genetics to help rid the world of ancient diseases. How she applied the rules described in this book to get this job. Pardee is a good example of the value of organizing your working life around a compelling mission. Many professors are overwhelmed by their jobs and eventually descend into a state of bitter cynicism. Pardee avoided this fate by dedicating her work towards something she finds important and exciting. Of equal importance is how she found her mission. Many people incorrectly believe that coming up with a mission is the easy part. It's something that just happens in a moment of inspiration, and that what's hard is mustering the courage to pursue it. Rule number 4 argued the opposite. It said that real missions, those that you can build a career around, require that you build up extensive amounts of expertise before they can be identified. Once they are identified, however, pursuing them is often a no-brainer. This is exactly what we find in the story of Pardee. It took years of skill acquisition before Pardee was able to identify the mission that now defines her career. After college, she went on to earn her PhD in genetics. Not quite sure what she wanted to do with her life, she also went to medical school. It wasn't until after finishing medical school and spending time as a postdoctoral fellow that she finally had enough expertise in her field to sift out this exciting new opportunity. Overall, Pardee's most important commitment was to patience. She didn't try to force a direction for her working life, but instead built up her career capital and kept her eyes open for the interesting directions she knew this process would uncover. Kirk French, introduced in Rule Number 4. Current job. Kirk teaches archaeology at Penn State University and is the co-host of a television show on the Discovery Channel that lets him travel the country helping people figure out the historical importance of their keepsakes and heirlooms. Why he loves what he does. As a teacher, Kirk has long been interested in spreading the word about modern archaeology. Ever since being interviewed for a documentary on the Mayan culture, Kirk's specialty, he has also been interested in media as a vehicle for popularizing archaeology. Landing a television show has been a fantastic realization of these interests. How he applied the rules described in this book to get this job. Kirk organized his archaeological career around the mission of popularizing his field. This mission has helped him turn an academic career that could become dry or overwhelming into a source of adventure and fulfillment. As with Pardee, this mission first required career capital. In Kirk's case, this came in the form of his PhD. His story, however, also highlights the first of two strategies presented in Rule Number 4 for helping career missions, once they're identified, succeed. The idea to host a television show did not come to Kirk out of the blue. Instead, he explored his general mission idea to popularize archaeology by means of a series of little bets. Many of these, such as his attempts to raise finances for a documentary, failed. But these failures were important, as they helped Kirk shift his attention away from non-productive directions. In the end, it was one of these bets that led him directly to his television show. He decided to film a visit to a local man who claimed to have found the Knights Templars treasure buried in his suburban Pittsburgh property. Not long afterward, a producer wrote Kirk's department chair looking for ideas for an archaeology-related television show. Kirk saw the email and sent the producer his Knights Templar tape. The producer loved it, and not long after, a show concept was born with Kirk as the host. Building the expertise to identify a quality career mission is the first step toward leveraging this trait. As Kirk's story demonstrated, deploying a series of little bets to feel out the best way forward with his mission is a good second step. Giles Boquette, introduced in Rule Number 4. Current job. Giles is a well-known Ruby software programmer. His renown has allowed him to shift between many jobs, following his interest of the moment. He's worked for the country's top ruby shop, supported himself entirely off of blog income, helped a Hollywood movie star launch a web-based entertainment venture, and most recently started writing a book. Why he loves what he does. Because Giles has a hyperkinetic personality, his ability to jump from one interesting job to another, moving on once something becomes boring, is a perfect match for his rapidly shifting attention. Spend any time around Giles, and you'll realize how miserable he would be if forced by economic necessity into a long-term traditional 40-hour-a-week job. How he applied the rules described in this book to get this job. Giles is another example of mission being used as the foundation for a great career. In this case, the mission is combining the worlds of the arts and Ruby programming. Giles made this mission a success when he released Archaeopteryx, an open-source software program that writes and performs its own music. This software gave Giles the fame within his community that has supported his kinetic career trajectory ever since. Like Pardee and Kirk, Giles needed career capital before he could identify his mission. He seriously studied and performed music, and spent many years developing his programming skills before he was at a sufficient level of expertise to recognize the potential in combining these worlds. His story, however, also captures the second of the two strategies presented in Rule Number 4 for helping missions once identified to succeed. This second strategy, which I called the Law of Remarkability, says that a good mission-driven project should be remarkable in two ways. First, it should compel people to remark about it. And second, it should be deployed in a venue conducive to remarking. These were the rules that led Giles to his idea for Archaeopteryx. He recognized that a demo of a piece of computer code-generating sophisticated music would be something that would catch people's attention. He had also realized that the open-source software community was well-structured to spread the word about interesting projects, making it a perfect venue for the software's release. Combined, these two traits made the project, and therefore Giles' career mission, a success. Acknowledgements. The decision to write this book can be traced back to a series of posts on the passion hypothesis that I first published on my blog, Study Hacks. The reaction from my readers was immediate and voluminous. Their feedback helped shape and focus my thinking on this topic, and convinced me that this was a discussion worth sharing with a wider audience. As such, I thank them for spurring me into starting this project. It was at this point that my publishing team entered the picture. My longtime agent and mentor, Lori Abkemeyer, worked her magic and helped me transform my diverse thoughts into a cohesive book proposal. The book ended up with Rick Wolf at Grand Central Business Plus, and I couldn't be happier about this turn of events. Rick is the type of editor authors hope for. He understood my idea at a gut level, and his enthusiasm for it never waned. He helped me find the right voice for expressing these provocative arguments in a way that people would accept. The book is indisputably better due to his efforts. Finally, my wife, Julie, was indispensable in the writing process. She not only read drafts of my work in progress, but also listened through endless iterations of my thinking, always offering honest and clear feedback. She was joined in these efforts by my friend, Ben Casnoka, who conceived, sold, and wrote a career advice book concurrently with my own, allowing us to share numerous useful conversations at all stages of the process. This has been a Hachette Audio production of So Good They Can't Ignore You, Why Skills Trump Passion in the Quest for Work You Love, written by Cal Newport, read by Dave Mallow. Executive Producer, Michelle McGonigal. Produced and directed by Dennis Kao. Audio edited, mixed, and mastered by Jeremy Wesley. Production supervised by Christine M. Farrell. So Good They Can't Ignore You is also available in print and as an ebook from Business Plus, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 2012 by Calvin C. Newport. Audio production copyright and published 2012 by Hachette Audio. all rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher is unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.